Welcome to the 261st episode of the 4th and 24 podcast with Patrick Winograd. I'm your host for today, Patrick Winograd. In this edition of the podcast, our topics are an overview of my weekend predictions, an overview of recent NBA playoff action, and our weekly look at MLB. But let's jump right in with a look back at my weekend predictions, which are posted every Thursday on our site, 4thand24.com. Starting in the NBA, I went 3-0 in predictions. Those were all Game 6 predictions, but of course there was no Game 6 in the Boston series. We'll get to that later. But the Timberwolves beat the Nuggets 115-70 to force a Game 7. That one, a big surprise. We'll talk about that in a second. The Mavs beat the Thunder 117-116, and the Pacers beat the Knicks 116-103, which I got right. But you know, starting at the Timberwolves Nuggets series, look, the Timberwolves. That game, I mean, I think everybody expected, you know, all these games to be close, but throughout the series, there have been some games that have not been as close as others, so I guess it's not too surprising that that happened, but the Timberwolves, after the Nuggets had won three straight, they came out and won that Game 6 to even up the series and send it to a Game 7 in Denver, and then the Mavericks beat the Thunder 117-116. That actually closed out the series. I should have said that. I think I said it sent it to Game 7. But the Mavs, big comeback in that game. Get into it more later. Then the Pacers beat the Knicks 116-103. The home team was winning most of the games in the series. And that trend continued with the Pacers winning that game. Although, of course, as we now know, that trend did flip later on. But it was the Pacers coming out with a Game 6 win. To make it so that the home team had won the first six games of the series, and then we'll talk about what happened in Game 7 later. But for now, 3-0 in NBA predictions, and in MLB, I went 3-1. So a pretty good week overall. 6-1 is the overall record on the week. 1,068-684 overall. A 61.0% winning percentage is really rounded up from 60.95, but, you know, it is what it is. I'll take the positive rounding there. But in MLB, the Orioles took 2 of 3 from the Mariners. I got that series correct. Gunnar Henderson hit, I think, 2 or 3 home runs throughout the series. Actually, yeah, he hit 3. He hit one in every single game. Led off the first game of the series with a home run after the Mariners had gotten a few runs off of John Means, but the Orioles responded with 5 runs of their own in the first, and they won that game. Went on to win the Sunday game as well in the series rubber match. The Tigers took 2 of 3 from the Diamondbacks. This one I didn't really know who to pick. Both of the teams had pretty even pitching matchups. Both of the teams have pretty good pitching in general. But the problem was that, you know, the Tigers, their record isn't good. You know, Reese Olson had been, not undefeated, but actually had not won a game yet on the season, despite having a sub-2 ERA, which is crazy. But look, you know, if the pitching matchups are even, I'm going to pick the Diamondbacks because they tend to get better run support, even though they've kind of struggled to start out the year themselves, and the Tigers have been above 500. So I did end up picking the Diamondbacks, but they did not win the series. It was the Tigers who came out on top, took 2 of 3 on the road. And then the Guardians swept the Twins, big important matchup in that division. Guardians not really having the pitching advantage overall in the series, but I thought close enough in a few games, and I think the Guardians are the better overall team. The Twins did have their really, really good stretch, but since then they've just kind of been, you know, a little bit falling back down to earth, so I picked the Guardians for that reason. Guardians have been a little more consistent all year long, and overall I think they did have pretty even pitching matchups, so I'll go with the better team when the pitching matchups are even, and I thought they were in the series. So I picked the Guardians, and I was right. They got that sweep, like I said. And as a result, with one more series left, actually, I should say, almost forgot to mention it, but the Rays took 2 of 3 from the Blue Jays. Blue Jays were already done in this series by the third game. Alek Manoah did pitch a good game on Sunday to help the Blue Jays avoid the sweep, but it was the Rays who still took the overall series. Took 2 out of 3, and meant that I had a 3-1 week. So that is all we have for the weekend predictions recap. My predictions for next weekend will be posted on our website, as always, on Thursday. But let's now turn to the NBA, starting in the Western Conference semifinals. We will, of course, start with Minnesota against Denver. Minnesota winning that series in seven games, taking the final two games of the series after the Nuggets won Game 5. But we'll start, of course, in that Game 5, go game by game real quick, talk about some of the stats, some of the threads. You know, Game 5 was probably one of the closer games of the series. 112-97 was the final score. Karl Anthony Towns led the way for the Timberwolves with 23. Gobert had 18 points on 7 of 7 shooting, but of course didn't get too many shots off, although that kind of changed in Game 7, and we'll get to that later. But Ant had 18 points. Nikhil Alexander-Walker had 14. But on the Denver side of things, it was Nikola Jokic, of course, carrying it. 40 points for him, 13 assists, 7 rebounds, just unstoppable in that game. There was no way Minnesota was going to win the series if he kept playing like this in general. Christian Brown also had 10 off the bench. No one else above 20 for the Nuggets. Aaron Gordon had 18. Jamal Murray and KCP both had 16. But KCP actually had 16 points, 5 rebounds, 4 assists on 6 of 8 shooting. Jamal Murray didn't even attempt a 3. 7 of 14 from the floor. So KCP actually had the better game than Jamal Murray did. But, you know, Michael Porter Jr., he struggled in this game too, but what Jokic was doing was just way too much for the Timberwolves to overcome. And enough threes between Jokic going 2 of 3, KCP going 4 of 5, and then even the two that Michael Porter Jr. hit obviously had an impact on the game, although he was just 2 of 10 from the floor, 2 of 7 from 3 overall. But look, Nuggets came out with this win, and it looked like they were going to win the series, honestly, from there, considering they had one game on the road, one game at home, and close it out, defending champs. But then, in Game 6, the momentum shifted again. I mean, the Timberwolves just demolished the Nuggets. Came out with way more intensity on the defensive end. Held Jokic this game to 22 points. Murray had 10 points on 4 of 18 shooting. Aaron Gordon had 12 points, but those were the only three players in double figures for the Nuggets. KCP was 2 of 6 from 3. No threes off the bench, 7 of 36 as a team from the three-point line. Aaron Gordon, actually, with the best percentage, shooting 2 of 4 from 3 in that game. But on the Timberwolves side of things, a lot of players in double figures, of course, 5 of them. To be exact, Rudy Gobert had 14 rebounds to go with 8 points. He's probably the most impactful player with single-digit points. But Naz Reid had 10 points, 11 rebounds off the bench. Mike Conley had 13 points, 5 assists, 4 rebounds. Anthony Edwards had 27 points, 4 assists, 4 rebounds. And Karl Anthony Towns had 10 points, 5 assists, 13 rebounds. But again, Jaden McDaniels and Ant both with 20 leading the way. And, you know, it's harder to talk about some of the stats and the impacts in this game because, of course, it was over so early, 115-70 being the score, that, you know, there were a lot of points from garbage time players, of course. 29-9 in the fourth quarter. By the Timberwolves. So even when the garbage time minutes started, it was still the Timberwolves dominating that game. But they did take the momentum into Game 7, although, of course, Denver had still won 3 of the last 4. If you were to go back from the span, going from Game 3 to Game 6. And in Game 7, the Nuggets did jump out to a lead. They were up 58-38 at some point in this game. Jokic had 34 points, 19 rebounds, 7 assists. But he was 2 of 10 from 3, started the game 0 of 7. It looks like he was going to get a new rhythm late, but it was just a little bit too late for really from everybody. Jamal Murray had 35 points as well, but no one else had above 7 points on the entire team. Michael Porter Jr., 3 of 12, 1 of 6 from 3. KCP, 1 of 4 from 3, only had 5 points. Aaron Gordon only had 4 points. He only had 4 rebounds as well. So Denver just got outworked on the boards, had no production from anybody outside of Jokic and Murray. And in the end, that was all the Timberwolves needed. Ant had a really rough game, shooting 6 of 24. But he picked it up in the third quarter, ended up with 16, 7, and 8. Mike Conley had 10 points, 8 rebounds, 4 assists himself. Cat had 23 points, 12 rebounds, 2 assists, excuse me. He did almost foul out, though, having 5 fouls. And actually had to sit a lot of the fourth quarter as a result. But Rudy Gobert was out there pouring in fadeaways. I mean, this was a crazy performance by the Timberwolves, something that honestly I didn't expect, especially even if you had told me they were going to win the game. That is not the fashion I would have thought it would happen in. But then Jaden McDaniels had 23 points of his own, tying Cat for the team lead, 7 of 10 shooting for him. Some late putback dunks by him and Naz Reid really helped put the game away for the Timberwolves. But a big run. They were down 20, like I said, went on a 21-3 run. That run, I think, extended was all the way something like 55-22 or something like that. I don't know. Something near that range. I know they were down 58-38. You can do the math on how big of a run that was from that point to the very end of the game. But, of course, the Timberwolves, they take that series. And even more importantly, since they will be playing the team we're about to talk about, Dallas, they have home court now. Until they play Boston, then they wouldn't have home court anymore. But they do have the second best record remaining in the playoffs. So they would have home court over anybody except for Boston, which is an interesting thing to monitor. But of course, before we talk about the Western Conference Finals and our predictions for that, you got to talk about the other series in the West, where, of course, as I just spoiled a little bit, the Mavericks defeated OKC in six games. The Mavs, you know, more experienced team. It came through by the end. They went on the road, won game five, had a big halftime lead at that game. They were up by 10 at the half, 54-44. And really, the Thunder just never cracked the code of how to get themselves back into the game. The Mavs outscored them in the third by two, and they tied points in the fourth quarter. So the Thunder just never cut into the deficit enough. Luka Doncic had 31, 11, and 10, triple-double for the triple-double machine himself. The bigs for the Mavs were huge in this game, no pun intended. Daniel Gafford had 9.7 rebounds. Derek Lively had 11 points, 10 rebounds off the bench. So like I said, the bigs coming in with some huge contributions. Derek Jones Jr., I almost called him Daniel Jones, it's not football season yet. Derek Jones Jr. had 19 points, 3 of 5 from 3 for him, which is something that, you know, sometimes he's not exactly the best percentage three-point shooter and definitely doesn't take too many, but, you know, he's more of a high-flyer dunker type. But look, he played great in this game. P.J. Washington had 10 points, 10 rebounds. And on the other side of things, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander did his thing, of course. He gets you 30 points. He doesn't get you 32. He doesn't get you 28. It's always right at 30 somehow. I mean, it's like a magic act how he always gets there. But 30 points, 8 assists, 6 rebounds for him. But outside of that, no one really assertive enough for the Thunder. Josh Giddey had 11 points in 12 minutes off the bench, which was really quick production for him, but obviously not in the starting lineup for once, which normally he is. But Chet Holmgren had only 13. Jalen Williams had 12. The other Jalen Williams only had 3, the one from Arkansas, the big man, Jalen Williams. Aaron Wiggins only had 2 points on 2 shots. Cason Wallace was 1-for-7 from the floor. So really outside of Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, no one else above 13 points in the game. And that just wasn't enough offense for the Thunder. They could not overcome the fact that Luka equaled Shai's performance, technically had a better game. They shot the exact same percentage, Luka hitting more threes, Shai hitting more free throws, Luka with more assists, more rebounds, and then Luka had better support. Derek Jones Jr., second leading scorer outside of those two, only got to get above 13 points on either team, not named Luka Doncic or Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. Obviously, Kyrie Irving didn't even have that big of an impact himself on this game. I mean, normally you would expect him to have a huge impact on this type of a game, but only 12 points for him, so nothing crazy when you think about it. But 5 of 11 shooting, pretty efficient. And then in Game 6, the Mavs went back home. They made a, I wouldn't say miraculous comeback, but a pretty big comeback. They were down at some point in this game by 17 points, and they came back, got the win over the Thunder to close it out, 117-116. I won't lie to you guys, I was at a concert during this, so I can't tell you much that happened in this game from a play-by-play perspective, but what I can tell you is that I did watch the highlights after. Thunder obviously had a 64-47 lead at the half, so that is when it was 17, so it's, or 48, excuse me, bad math. But look, the Mavs came out in the third quarter, outscored the Thunder there, did it again in the fourth. P.J. Washington's free throws ended up winning the game for the Mavs. A lot of good production offensively on either side, obviously. Just judging by the score, that's pretty obvious. But Thunder shot 48% from the field, 37% from three. The Mavs shot 51% from the field, 47% from three. Out-rebounded the Thunder 47-31 in this game. The Thunder only with 7 offensive rebounds, the Mavs with 14. and 17 turnovers for the Mavs compared to the Thunder's 8, but a lot fewer shots for the Mavs because of those turnovers, but at the same time, they evened it out just enough with the rebounding advantage, and they just shot so much of a better percentage that didn't really matter. Every player in the Thunder starting lineup was in double figures. Lu Dort and Isaiah Joe, 11 points each, were the kind of ancillary contributions. But then you have Shea, who had 36 points, 8 assists, 3 rebounds, 14 of 25 from the floor. Jalen Williams almost had a triple-double. He had 22 points, 8 assists, 9 rebounds. And Chet Holmgren had 21 points and 3 rebounds. But again, Chet just getting bullied on the glass. I mean, it is what it is. Derek Lively had 12 points and 15 rebounds off the bench. Daniel Gafford had 10 points and 7 rebounds as a starter in this game. And then P.J. Washington was the only starter actually in the entire game that wasn't in double figures. But Kyrie had 22 points on 9 of 23, shooting 4 of 10 from 3. Luka had 29, 10, and 10. Probably the fewest shots he's taken in a game, honestly, the entire playoffs, which is pretty interesting that it would come in this game, but they did close it out. Derek Jones Jr., again, another good game for him, 22 points, 4-6 from 3. So, you know, maybe the Mavs have found an extra weapon there, scoring not just P.J. Washington, not just Hardaway when he's on with his shot, but also Derek Jones Jr. He's now starting to kind of hit his stride as we go into the conference finals. But before we give the predictions on the Western Conference Finals, we'll continue, of course, with the conference semifinals. Moving on to the Eastern Conference, where Indiana beat New York in 7 games. Of course, that series ending after the Knicks did take a 3-2 lead, but just the injuries just kept piling up. We talked about the fact that the Knicks were running out of gas in Game 4 already, and it kind of persisted throughout the rest of the series. No OG Anunoby in Game 5, and basically beyond. We'll get to Game 7. That's kind of the caveat to that, but basically no OG for the rest of the series. Dante DiVincenzo couldn't get a shot going in this game. 8 points for him. Hartenstein had 7 points. 17 rebounds, though, and 5 assists as well in his 31 minutes. But pretty much no production from anyone outside of their 4 scorers in this game. Miles McBride, 17. Josh Hart, 18 points. And Alec Burks, 18 points. And then Jalen Brunson had the big, big 44-point game. 7 assists, 4 rebounds. But again, that got them 121 points pretty much from just 4 players scoring. I mean, it's crazy how the Knicks can do that over and over and over again. Of course, as we know now, it would come to an end. But the Knicks did steal this game at home. Halliburton only took 9 shots in this game despite shooting over 50% from the field. 13 points, 5 assists. It's really the biggest criticism you can have of him. He's just not assertive at all, and he should be more assertive. He is the leader of that team. He is their star. He needs to shoot more. And he did it in Game 7, and we'll get to that in a little bit. But, you know, that needs to be more of a consistent thing for him. He shouldn't be waiting until the biggest moments of the series. And I'm not the only person saying this. It's not the first time I've said it either. It's not the first time anybody said it. A lot of people have been saying it a lot. But the Pacers, you know, shot an okay percentage as a team, 44% from 3, but 43% overall. Got worked on the boards by the Knicks for sure in this one. Hartenstein alone had 12 offensive rebounds compared to the Pacers having 24 defensive rebounds as a team. So that's really what propelled the Knicks. No amazing performances like with shooting percentages as a team. It was just the fact that they had such an advantage on how many shots they had off of getting all those offensive rebounds, out-rebounded by more than 20 rebounds in that game. But then, Game 6, tired legs caught up to the Knicks. They came out in this game, didn't look too good. They played, I guess you can say they played okay. They started out with the lead at the end of the first quarter, but they did end up falling behind in the second quarter. They had a 1-point lead at the end of the first, ended up trailing by 10 going into the half. Pacers leading it 59-51. Again, my bad math strike. No, 61-51. I was right. Bad math. Anyway, the Knicks had Jalen Brunson hit 31 points. So, you know, Jalen Brunson always getting his 30 points, but on 11 of 26 shooting, so not quite as efficient. Miles McBride did have 20 on 8 of 12 shooting, and Dante DiVincenzo did come in clutch with 17 points on 6 of 14 shooting. But even though DiVincenzo had a better game, Josh Hart had a worse game. He only had 5 points. Precious Achiuwa had 12 points off the bench. Alec Burks had 11 points off the bench. So, some good production from the Knicks, but just not enough when they don't have a 40 bomb from Brunson and you know, those three other guys that get significant minutes. They need a fourth guy, really, to have. They either need a second guy to step up a lot, or they need six guys who are kind of in that 10 to 12 point range, and then Brunson in the 30 point range. Or they need Brunson in the 40 point range, and, you know, three or four guys in that 10 to 12 point range. That's just the math of it with how short their rotation is. But on the Pacers side of things, they did play better in this game. Didn't get out-rebounded this time, actually out-rebounded the Knicks by one on the offensive glass and by 12 overall. Obi Toppin had 11 points on 5 of 6 off the bench. TJ McConnell had 15 points and 4 assists off the bench himself in his 16 minutes. Isaiah Jackson had 4 points, 3 assists, 3 rebounds. So, 3 good players off the bench for the Pacers. And then in the starting lineup, Aaron Nesmith didn't hit a 3 but had 8 points, 4 assists, 6 rebounds. Still managed to impact the game in other ways. Pascal Siakam had 25 points, 7 rebounds, 5 assists. Halliburton had 15 points, 9 assists, 6 rebounds. Nembhard had 15 points, 6 assists, 6 rebounds. And Miles Turner had 17 points, 3 assists, 8 rebounds. So a lot of guys making a lot of impact for the Pacers. 5 different players who hit 6 shots or more. But at the same time, Halliburton still could have been more assertive. They did win the game, though, of course. So no complaint there. And then in Game 7, Tyrese Halliburton did get more assertive. Took 17 shots, took 12 threes, 26 points, 6 assists, 4 rebounds. As the Pacers won this game 130-109. No pun intended, they just pushed the pace the entire game. OG Anunoby gave it a go. He tried to play. Only played 5 minutes, about 5 minutes. It wasn't even a full 5 minutes in this game. Jalen Brunson was 6 of 17, then left the game with a broken hand. I mean, it was just a rough one for the Knicks. You know, Dante DiVincenzo had 39. Brunson did have 17 before he exited the game. And then Josh Hart had 10, but other than that, it was Alec Burks and Dante DiVincenzo in double figures with 39 and 26. Miles McBride played 40 minutes, but only had 8 points. So just not enough offense for the Knicks at all. Even Hartenstein didn't score at all. But then, on the Pacers side of things, nothing from Obi Toppin in this game, but every single starter 17 points in this game. Like I said, Halliburton 26, 6, and 4. But J.J. McConnell off the bench had 12 points. Isaiah Jackson had 9 points off the bench. You combine that with the fact that Siakam had 20, Nesmith had 19, Turner had 17, Nembhard had 20, like I said. Just so much production from the Pacers that it was a little hard. It was too hard to overcome for the Knicks. And the Pacers just kept pushing the pace, knowing that the Knicks were so tired throughout this series. And they take advantage of it, and they end up taking the series and moving on, of course, to play Boston. I'm not even going to call that a spoiler. I think everybody knew that before the series even started, that that was going to be the matchup. Well, I shouldn't say that. No one, not necessarily everybody knew it was going to be Boston versus Indiana, but everybody knew that Boston was going to win this series. But Game 5, no Donovan Mitchell for the Cavs. Made it obviously even worse than it already was, the situation going in. You know, Boston was favored by 15.5 coming into this game. And they had 6 double-figure scorers to ice the game. Jason Tatum, 25 points, 9 assists, 10 rebounds. Al Horford, 22 points, 15 rebounds, 5 assists for him, 6 threes for him. Derek White, 18 points, 6 assists, 5 rebounds. Jrue Holiday, 13 points. Jaylen Brown, 11 points. And Peyton Pritchard, 11 off the bench. For the Cavs, some unlikely heroes, honestly. Marcus Morris Sr. with 25 points on 10 of 13 shooting, including 5 of 6 from 3. Sam Merrill had 3 made threes on 9 points in the whole game. But it just wasn't enough. Darius Garland, I don't know why I called him Derek. Darius Garland didn't do enough. 4 of 17 in that game. Max Strus, 3 of 10. You know, if you're looking at this lineup, there are like no scorers in here. I'm not even going to sugarcoat it. Mobley had 33 points. Took 24 shots in the game. He never takes that many shots, and it's not a fact that he can't, and he can't, you know, carry the load as a scorer. He did at USC. That's exactly what he did his entire career at USC. But the thing is, he's not supposed to be a guy that's taking 20-plus shots a game. He was forced to because of the fact that they just got too many injuries. No Jared Allen, no Donovan Mitchell. Allen normally splitting kind of the post-ups, the rebounds, that kind of thing. And then, obviously, Donovan Mitchell taking a lot of the shots as he goes in his bag. But the thing is, the Cavs didn't have either of those two. Dean Wade ended up starting in this game. Hadn't even been playing minutes through most of the series, honestly. Or through at least the first round, he barely played at all. And then in this series, played a little bit more. But Okoro only ended up playing 12 minutes. Like I said, Marcus Morris had some strong contributions. But the Celtics just have way too many weapons, even with Porzingis out, against a team that's as shorthanded as the Cavs were in that game. Which brings us to the final point. That, of course, it is now time for the conference finals, and we have our predictions ready in the Western Conference Finals. Of course, we have Dallas against Minnesota. Minnesota with home court advantage. We do have differing picks here, which has been rare this postseason. But I am picking Dallas to win the series in seven games. My dad is picking Minnesota to win it in seven games. Of course, he's not here. I just think Dallas is one of those teams that's just been making steady progression every single year, going a little bit farther in the playoffs. And I feel like it's finally the year. You know, Kyrie's been healthy all year long. Luka has been almost bringing that team single-handedly all the way. Pretty much the entire time. They just won a series without home court. They beat the Thunder. They've played a young team before. I know that the Timberwolves have more experience than the Thunder do, but the Mavs still actually somehow are one of the more experienced teams in all of the postseason. I think out of the teams left, they actually have the second most, only second to Boston, obviously. But look, they just have a lot of production between Luka and Kyrie. Kyrie has not played his best basketball yet, and he still can level it up for this series, which is what I think will happen. That's what I think is the X factor for me. I feel like we've seen a lot of Ant's best. We've seen a lot of Luka's best, frankly, at times. Both of them, you could say the same thing. And I feel like we've seen the good version of Kat. We've seen some of the bad version of Kat in foul trouble. But I really do think that, you know, we might see a little bit more of that. Kat's going to have a lot of trouble keeping Lively and Gafford off the boards. And I think it's going to be the same thing for Rudy Gobert. They're going to have some trouble with the Mavs' bigs. And I really do think that, at the very least, the Mavs stretching the floor with guys like PJ Washington will help out even more. And Dallas wins the series as a result. My dad picking against me, though, picking Minnesota. It will be a close series, though. It will be a really fun series. But I do have Dallas winning it. And then in the Eastern Conference, no differing picks. We both have the Celtics. But I have the Celtics in seven. I think the series is going to be really close without Porzingis. I think that, you know, Miles Turner, he's going to do his thing while Porzingis is out, maybe first two or three games or so. Don't quite know his status for the whole series. And then either Porzingis is going to come back and really propel the Celtics to the victories, or they just win anyway without him. I mean, I do think the Celtics are the better team here in this series, but I think that the pace that they're going to get thrown at them by the Pacers, no pun intended again, but I mean, it's just the same word. I think that's going to be the big difference that'll keep the series really close, and Boston will be pushed to seven, pushed to the brink. It's hard to beat Indiana on the road either, but I do think Indy will keep it close. Boston wins in seven, though, and in the end, you get Boston and Dallas in the finals for me, Minnesota and Boston in the finals, the Kevin Garnett special for my dad are our official predictions. But now it's time to move on to the MLB weekly recap. Starting in the American League with the AL East, the Yankees lead the division at 33-16. That's also the best record in the American League overall. They are 8-2 in their last 10, so a strong stretch recently for the Yankees to put themselves in this position. Actually, it's the second best record in all of baseball, only trailing the leaders of the NL East, which we will talk about in a little bit here. But of course, in second place, you have the Baltimore Orioles at 29-16, same in the loss column, but four games back in the win column, two games back overall. Good run differential for them, good season so far, nothing to complain about for either of these two teams. They were the favorites at the top of the division. They will be the teams competing for it throughout the year, really. It's just what the story is going to be. Then you have the Rays and the Red Sox in the same logjam as always, this time the Rays, though. Coming out on top, 25-24 is their record, 6-4 in their last 10. They do have a negative 34 run differential, because of the horrible start that their pitching got off to at the beginning of the year, but that has started to stabilize, and they played better as a team as a result of that. And then, of course, Boston, 24-24, plus 33 run differential, so actually, technically a pretty unlucky team, despite the fact that, you know, if you look at their roster, you might think that they would be a team with maybe a negative run differential that has a good record, but it's actually the opposite. This roster, I think, is a lot better than people give it credit for, especially with the pitching staff. But they're 5-5 in their last 10, 500 on the year as well. They're a good team. Nothing too special, but not as bad as people build them out to be at the beginning of the season. Meanwhile, the definite disappointment in this division, the Toronto Blue Jays at 21-25. Alek Manoah did turn in a good start over the weekend, but of course, kind of up and down all over the place with that pitching staff. Yusei Kikuchi has probably been the most consistent over the last few years in terms of staying near the same level, but, you know, Barrios is sometimes up, sometimes down, mostly up recently, though, obviously. But Gausman this year has had a rough start to the year. Manoah obviously had his struggles last year to start this year, but then had this good start recently. You just kind of don't know what you're going to get from that pitching staff. Jordan Romano has blown a few games, too. But overall, AL East, a very, very competitive division top to bottom, and it starts, of course, at the top with the Yankees and the Orioles. Then you move on to the AL Central, another competitive division. The Guardians at 31-17 with the second-best record in the American League, just barely better on winning percentage than the Orioles are. But they have won four in a row. They're 7-3 in their last 10. So are the Royals. Their run differential between these two teams, only one run apart. The Royals, though, 1.5 games back at 30-19. Then you have the Twins, who are 6.5 back at 24-23. Obviously, they were on a little bit of a hot streak, but they have completely cooled off, gone ice cold. They've lost 7 in a row. Run differential is now negative on the year. Pablo Lopez had a really bad start yesterday. And overall, things just not going too well for them. The Guardians swept them over the weekend, as I mentioned in my weekend predictions. So not a good look for them overall, but it is what it is. They are still in third in the division. Then you have the Tigers, who did win their weekend series against the Diamondbacks, but lost the last game in the series, first game of their series against the Royals, to fall below 500. 23-24 is their record, 7.5 back in the division for them. Then in last place, you have the White Sox, who are 14-34. 292 is their winning percentage on the year, which does make them the worst team in baseball. They have reclaimed that title after the Marlins have had an okay week and a half that we'll talk about later. But that's all we have for the Central. Again, another pretty competitive division with the Guardians and the Royals anchoring things at the top. Then you have the Mariners leading the AL West with a 26-22 record. Their starters just continue to be really good. Their offense really has not come along. They are the only team outside of, you know, the really, really bad teams that have, you know, fewer than 190-ish runs. The best team with a winning, or excuse me, the worst offense with a winning record in the American League, that's not the Mariners. It's the Tampa Bay Rays with 198 runs. The Mariners only have 182 by comparison, but somehow four games above 500, they'll take it. 6-4 in their last 10. Meanwhile, the Rangers are slumping. They are 24-24 on the year, but 3-7 in their last 10 to get there. And then the Astros have finally climbed out of last in this division. I don't know why it was like that for so long, but, you know, they're 21-27 still. They're still five games back, but really a missed opportunity by both the Mariners and the Rangers to build some separation over the team that dominates this division, as now the Astros have kind of hit their stride, 7-3 in their last 10, and all of a sudden they're only five games back, which shouldn't seem possible given how bad their start was to the season. But the Rangers are sitting there at 500, only three games ahead of them. And the Mariners, of course, only four games above, so not that far ahead either. And then at the bottom of the division, you have the Angels, who are 19-29, and the A's, who are 19-30. After losing 8 in a row, so the A's, unfortunately, after, you know, like I said, they reached 17-17 to get to 500, but since then it has been a struggle. And of course, now they are sitting with the second worst record in the American League, only a better record than the Chicago White Sox, who will definitely be the worst team all year long. But now let's turn our attention to the National League, where, of course, we will start with the Philadelphia Phillies, who were 34-14 now. That's a 708 winning percentage, and that is the best record in baseball. If you didn't know that, they have been just hot for a month now, maybe more than that. But just they're playing great baseball as a team. Their pitching staff has been super, super good over the past few weeks, especially 8-2 in their last 10. The only team with a better run differential in the entire majors are the Dodgers, and we'll get to them later. But of course, if the Phillies aren't first at 34-14 with an 8-2 record in their last 10, that does mean that the Braves are in second. Not a place that they're accustomed to being, but, you know, they did have the one divisional race where they were behind the Mets for most of the year and then came back to win that one anyway and went farther in the playoffs than the Mets did. So, you know, it's not like the Braves haven't dealt with it before, but, you know, we definitely expected this year for that not to be the case. But, of course, the Spencer Strider injury, testing the depth of the Braves pitching staff, and Ronald Acuna's lackluster start to the season. I mean, maybe lackluster isn't the right word because he's still having a good season by regular people's standards, but following up an MVP campaign, he has not been himself. But they're still 27-17. You know, it's a 614 winning percentage. It's still the third best record in the National League. So as much as you could talk negative about this team, third best run differential, third best record, nothing you can really complain about if you're the Braves, other than the fact that you're losing the division of the Phillies currently, but who knows how long the Phillies can keep this up. I do think they can for a decent amount, but not for forever. Then you have the Nats sitting at 21-25, 12 games back in the division, 3-7 in their last 10. The Mets, 21-26, 12.5 games back, 3-7 in their last 10, and in last with the second worst record in the National League, it's the Miami Marlins at 16-33 with a 6-4 record in their last 10. So they did climb out of the worst record spot that they were claiming while the White Sox were playing a little bit better, I guess, for a second there. And now the Marlins, after they have a decent week and a half, like I mentioned earlier, no longer the worst team. And, you know, there's another team that we'll talk about later that almost climbed out of that themselves. But for now, Marlins' second worst team in the National League. Moving on to the worst division in the National League, the NL Central. I would still argue this pretty easily. But the Brewers, they're at 27-20, 574 winning percentage. It's been a while since the team who won the NL Central was really a dominant team, to be honest. It's been maybe 6 or 7 years, it feels like, at this point. It's always been, you know, whether it's the Braves, the Nats, or the Phillies in their best eras, those teams winning the East, and then whoever wins the West, typically the Dodgers, having better records than whoever comes out of the Central. And that just seems to be a trend pretty much since, maybe I want to say the 2016 Cubs, 2017 Cubs, I don't know. But look, regardless, Brewers 5-5 in their last 10. The Cubs, not much better, actually worse, 4-6 in their last 10. They're 26-22, barely behind them, but still, they still are. Then you have the Pirates at 22-26, 5.5 games back, 5-5 in their last 10. But of course, good news for them as Paul Skeens makes his debut and then his second appearance and looks really good in both of those games. And then you have the Cardinals, who are 21-26, 6-4 in their last 10. So they're starting to trend in the right direction, but still under 500. You know, they got to get better contributions from their pitching staff overall. Got to get more runs. They just haven't had the balance all year long. Maybe they're starting to find a little of it as they've been 6-4 in their last 10, like I said, but still need to keep it up for a longer stretch. Then you have the Reds, who have really been struggling recently. 19-28 is their record. They're 8 games back in last in the division, 3-7 in their last 10. Definitely had an opportunity to at least split the series with the Dodgers, but just couldn't put wins together, especially the extra innings game that they lost against the Dodgers. Probably had a few opportunities to win that one and couldn't quite do so, especially with the bases loaded opportunity that they had in the middle of their order, but they didn't convert on that. And speaking of the Dodgers, they are 33-17. The second highest win total overall, tied with the Yankees, of course. The third best record, if you're looking by percentage, in all the majors, and second best in the National League. They have won 4 in a row, 7-3 in their last 10, 21-6 in the last month. So the Dodgers, everything going right for them, except for the fact that they lost one series to the second place Padres, who are 25-25, eight games back. They're 5-5 in their last 10. Played decent against the Braves over the weekend. Like I said, beat the Dodgers in the series. The last team to beat the Dodgers in a series, actually, is the Dodgers have now won 7 of 8 series and took the first of the series against the Diamondbacks. Then you have the Giants, who are at 23-25. Got some bad news that Jung-Hoo Lee would be out for the season, of course, with an injury. But they're still playing a little bit better recently. They've won 4 in a row. They're 6-4 in their last 10, and they're 23-25. So they're starting to catch up a little bit, gain some ground on the rest of the NL West. They are ahead, of course, of the Arizona Diamondbacks, who are 22-26 on the season, 10 games back in the division, 5-5 in their last 10. And the team I mentioned earlier that almost climbed out of last was the Colorado Rockies. They swept the Padres earlier in the week. They are 7-3 in their last 10 overall, so playing better baseball, but they did lose 3 in a row, unfortunately. So they got to 15-28. That was their best mark of the season, but unfortunately fell right back off the big old cliff that you could call the Rocky Mountains if you wanted to. And, of course, now they sit with the worst record in the National League. Still a better record than the White Sox, though, after this recent stretch. So I guess that's something they can take some credit for. But that will be it with the NL West, which means that's the end of this edition of the 4th and 24 podcast. Please be sure to check out our next podcast, which will be on Tuesday, May 28th, where we will once again look back at my weekend predictions, have a look at Eastern Conference and Western Conference finals action, and have another weekly review of MLB action. In the meantime, please be sure to check out my additional content, including my picks for next weekend's games that will be posted, as always, on Thursday, and my MLB Power Rankings, which will be posted tomorrow. All of that on our website, 4thand24.com. That's the number 4, THAND, the number 24.com. Thank you for listening.